reach 350. When it was announced late Tuesday night that classes would not resume, phone calls were made. Plans were changed. The service was moved to the high school gymnasium, capacity of 2,000. The time was set at 1 p.m., with Dante's burial to follow immediately thereafter at the Greenwood Cemetery, next to his father. By noon, there were at least 2,000 people inside the gym and more waiting patiently to get in. Dante's casket was placed at one end, under a raised backboard and goal, and it was surrounded by a massive sea of beautiful flower arrangements. On a screen above his casket, his handsome, smiling face greeted those who had come to say goodbye. His family sat in the front row in folding chairs, and as the crowd moved in, they gamely held on, greeting friends, hugging strangers, trying to keep their composure. A choir from his church stood near the flowers, singing and humming soft, comforting spirituals. Ms. Daphne Delmore, a saintly spinster who had once tried quite unsuccessfully to teach Dante drum the basics of the piano, accompanied the choir on an old upright Baldwin. To the right of the casket was a small elevated stage with a podium and a microphone, and before it, in rows of folding chairs, the Sloan Warriors sat together, every player present, along with their coaches and trainers. They proudly wore their blue home jerseys. Other than the football players, there were a few white faces sprinkled about, but not many. The media had been put in a box, literally. Under the stern direction of Marvin Drum, the reporters and their cameras were bunched into a tight pack at the opposite end of the building, under the opposing backboard, and they were sealed off by a row of chairs laced with yellow police tape. Large young black men in dark suits stood next to the tape, watching the reporters, who had been warned not to make a sound. Any violation would lead to expulsion, and quite possibly a broken leg out in the parking lot. The family was sick of reporters, as was most of the town. Roberta had wisely decided to close the coffin. She did not want the last image of Dante to be that of a lifeless corpse. She understood that a lot of people would be watching, and she preferred a smiling Dante. At 1:20, the gym was completely packed. The doors were closed, the choir stopped, and the Reverend Johnny Canty stepped to the podium. "We are here to celebrate a life," he said, "not to mourn a death." It sounded good, and there were a lot of amens, but the mood was far from celebratory. The air was heavy with sadness, but not the sadness that comes from loss. This was a sadness born of anger and injustice. The first prayer was offered by the Reverend Wilbur Woods, the white pastor of the First United Methodist Church of Sloan. Cedric Drum had called him with the invitation, which he readily accepted. He gave a lovely prayer, one that dwelled on love and forgiveness, and most important, justice. "The oppressed shall not remain the oppressed. Those responsible for injustice must one day face justice themselves." Reverend Wood's voice was soft but strong, and his words calmed the crowd. The sight of a white pastor standing on the stage with his eyes closed, his arms uplifted, his soul bared for all to see, soothed a lot of raw feelings, if only for the moment. Dante had never discussed his funeral. Therefore, his mother chose the music, the speakers, and the order of the service, and it would reflect the strong Christian faith of her family. Dante claimed to have given up his faith, but his mother had never believed it. The choir sang, "Just a closer walk with thee," and the tears flowed. There were breakdowns, loud emotional bursts, followed by sobbing and wailing. When things settled down, two eulogies followed. The first was by one of Dante's teammates, a young man who was now a doctor in Dallas. The second was by Robbie Flack. When Robbie walked to the podium, the crowd instantly stood and began a restrained applause. This was a church service. Clapping and cheering were frowned on. But some things cannot be helped. Robbie stood for a long time on the stage, nodding at the crowd, wiping tears, acknowledging the admiration, wishing he didn't have to be there. For a man who'd spent the past few days raging at the world and suing anyone who crossed his path, his comments were remarkably tame. He had never understood the love and forgiveness routine. Retaliation was what drove him. But he sensed that, at least for this moment, he should tone down his pugilistic instincts and just try to be nice. It was difficult. He talked about Dante in prison, their many visits, and even managed to get a laugh when recounting Dante's description of the food on death row. He read from two of Dante's letters and again found humor. He closed by describing his last few moments with Dante. He said, "Dante's last wish was that one day, when the truth was known, when Nicole's killer was identified, one day, when he was exonerated and his name was forever cleared, his family and friends would meet at his grave in the cemetery, throw a party, and tell the world that Dante Drum is an innocent man. Dante, we are planning the party." Cedric's 14-year-old son, Emmett, read a letter from the family, a long, gut-wrenching farewell to Dante, and did so with a composure that was startling. There was another hymn, then Reverend Canty preached for an hour. Keith and Dana watched the funeral live on cable from her mother's home in Lawrence, Kansas, the town of her youth. Dana's father was deceased, and her mother was a retired professor of accounting at the University of Kansas. After dropping the boys off at school, Keith and Dana decided to hit the road, to take a day trip and get out of town. Reporters were dropping by the church. The phones were ringing. The photo of him, Robbie, Martha, and Aaron was on the front page of the Topeka paper that morning, and Keith was weary of the attention and the questions. Plus, Boyette was out there fantasizing about his wife, and Keith just wanted her close. Billy, his mother-in-law, offered to fix lunch, and the offer was immediately accepted. As they watched the funeral, Billy kept saying, "I can't believe you were there, Keith." "Neither can I." It was so far away and so long ago, yet Keith could close his eyes and smell the disinfectant used to clean the holding cell where Dante waited. And he could hear the gasps as the curtains flew open and the family saw him on the gurney, tubes already in his veins. As he watched the funeral, his eyes moistened when he saw Robbie so warmly received, and he wept when Dante's nephew said goodbye. For the first time since leaving Texas, Keith had the urge to go back. Dante was laid to rest on the side of a long, sloping hill in Greenwood Cemetery, where most of the blacks were buried in Sloan. The afternoon had become overcast and chilly, and as his pallbearers strained to carry him the last 50 yards, a drum corps led the casket step by step, its steady, perfect rhythm echoing through the damp air. The family followed the casket until it was carefully placed on top of the grave, then settled into velvet-covered chairs inches from the fresh dirt. The mourners gathered tightly around the purple funeral tent. Reverend Canty said a few words, read some scripture, then gave the final farewell to their fallen brother. Dante was lowered into the ground next to his father. An hour passed and the crowd drifted away. Roberta and the family remained behind, under the tent, staring at the lowered casket and the dirt scattered on top of it. Robbie stayed with them, the only non-family member to do so. At 7 p.m. on Wednesday, the Sloan City Council met in an executive session to discuss the future of Detective Drew Kerber, who was made aware of the meeting but not invited. The door was locked. Only the 6 councilmen, the mayor, the city attorney, and a clerk were present. The lone black councilman, Mr. Varner, began by demanding that Kerber be fired immediately and that the city unanimously adopt a resolution condemning itself for its handling of the Dante Drum affair. It became readily apparent that nothing would be unanimous. With some difficulty, the council decided to postpone, if briefly, the passing of any resolutions. They would take these delicate matters one step at a time. The city attorney cautioned against the immediate firing of Kerber. As everyone knew, Mr. Flack had filed a mammoth lawsuit against the city, and the firing of Kerber would be tantamount to an admission of liability. Can we offer him early retirement? He's only been here 16 years, doesn't qualify. We can't keep him on the police force. Can we transfer him to Parks and Rec for a year or two? That ignores what he did in the drum case. Yes, it does. He needs to be fired. And so I take it that we, the city, plan to contest the allegations of the lawsuit. Are we seriously going to claim we have no liability? That's the initial position of our insurance lawyers. Then fire them and let's find some lawyers with good sense. The thing for us to do is to admit our police were wrong and settle this case. The sooner the better. Why are you so sure our police were wrong? Do you read newspapers? Do you own a television? I don't think it's that clear. That's because you've never seen the obvious. I resent that. Resent all you want. If you think we should defend the city against the Drum family, then you're incompetent and you should resign. I may resign anyway. Great. And take Drew Kerber with you. Kerber has a long record of bad behavior. He should never have been hired, and he should have been fired years ago. It's the city's fault he's still around, and I'm sure this will come out in court, right? Oh, yes. Court? Is anyone here in favor of going to court in this case? If so, then you need an IQ test. The debate raged out of control for 2 hours. At times, all six seemed to be talking at once. There were threats, insults, lots of name-calling and flip-flopping, and no consensus, though it was generally felt that the city should do whatever possible to avoid a trial. They finally voted. 3 to terminate Kerber, 3 to wait and see. As the tiebreaker, the mayor voted to get rid of him. Detectives Jim Morrissey and Nick Needham had taken part in the marathon interrogation that produced the fateful confession, but both had left Sloan and moved on to police departments in bigger cities. Chief Joe Radford had been the assistant chief 9 years earlier and, as such, had almost no involvement in the Yarber investigation. A motion was made to fire him, too, and it failed for lack of a second. Mr. Varner then raised the issue of the tear gas assault in Civitan Park the previous Thursday night and demanded that the city condemn its use. After another hour of hot debate, they decided to postpone further discussion. The streets were clear and quiet late Wednesday night. After a week of gathering, protesting, partying, and in some cases breaking laws, the demonstrators, protesters, guerrillas, fighters, whatever they called themselves, were tired. They could burn the entire town and disrupt life for a year, but Dante would remain peacefully at rest in Greenwood Cemetery. A few gathered in Washington Park to drink beer and listen to music, but even they had lost interest in throwing rocks and cursing the police. At midnight, the orders were given, and the National Guardsmen made a quick and silent exit from Sloan. Chapter 41. The summons from the bishop came by email early Thursday morning and was confirmed by a brief phone conversation in which nothing of substance was discussed. By 9 a.m., Keith and Dana were once again on the road, this time headed southwest on Interstate 35 to Wichita. As he drove, Keith recalled the same journey only a week earlier, same car, same radio station, but with a very different passenger. He had finally convinced Dana that Boyette was crazy enough to stalk her. The man had been arrested innumerable times, so he wasn't the craftiest criminal on the prowl. Until he was caught, Keith would not let his wife out of his sight. Keith was ignoring the office and the church. Dana's nonprofit work and jam-packed daily planners had been placed aside. Only the family mattered at the moment. If they had the flexibility and the money, Keith and Dana would have loaded up the boys and taken a long trip. She was concerned about her husband. He had witnessed a uniquely disturbing event, a tragedy that would haunt him forever. And though he'd been thoroughly unable to stop it or intervene in any manner, he was nonetheless burdened by it. He had told her several times how dirty he felt when the execution was over, how he wanted to go somewhere and take a shower, to cleanse himself of the perspiration and grime and fatigue and complicity. He wasn't sleeping and he wasn't eating. And around the boys, he worked hard to carry on the usual banter and games. But it was forced. Keith was detached, and as the days passed, she was beginning to realize that he was not snapping out of it. He seemed to have forgotten about the church. He had not mentioned a sermon or anything related to the upcoming Sunday. There was a pile of phone messages on his desk, all waiting to be returned. He'd corralled their assistant minister into presiding over the Wednesday night dinner, blaming it on a migraine. He'd never had a migraine, never faked being ill, and never asked someone to pinch hit in any situation. When he wasn't reading about the drum case or researching the death penalty, he was watching cable news, some of the same segments over and over. Something was brewing. The bishop was a man named Simon Priester, a huge, round ball of an old man who was married to the church and had absolutely nothing else to do but micromanage those under him. Though only in his early 50s, he looked and acted much older, with no hair except matching white patches above the ears, and a grotesque abdomen that bulged out and hung grossly over the hips. There'd never been a wife to scold him about his weight, or make sure his socks matched, or do something about the stains on his shirt. He spoke in soft, slow words, hands usually clasped in front of him, as if waiting for every word to come from above. Behind his back, he was known as the monk, usually in an affectionate tone, though often otherwise. Twice a year, on the second Sunday in March and the third Sunday in September, the monk insisted on preaching at St. Mark's in Topeka. He was a crowd killer. The few who came to hear him were the hardiest of the flock, but even they had to be cajoled into attending by Keith, Dana, and the staff. Because of the slim crowds, the monk was overly concerned about the health of St. Mark's. If you only knew, thought Keith, who couldn't imagine larger crowds at other churches on the monk's tour. The meeting was not urgent, though the initial email began with, "Dear Keith, I am deeply concerned." Simon had suggested a possible lunch, his favorite pastime, sometime the following week, but Keith had little else to do. In truth, a quick trip to Wichita gave him an excuse to leave town and spend the day with Dana. "I'm sure you've seen this," Simon said after they were properly arranged at a small table with coffee and frozen croissants. It was a copy of an editorial in the morning edition of the Topeka paper, something Keith had read 3 times before sunrise. "I have," Keith said. With the monk, it was always safer to use as few words as possible. He was brilliant in taking the loose ones, piecing them together, and tying them around your neck. Hands clasped, after a bite of croissant that had not been fully consumed because a large crumb was stuck on his lower lip, the monk said, "Don't get me wrong here, Keith. We are quite proud of you. What courage! You threw caution to the wind and raced off to a war zone to save a man's life. Dazzling, actually." "Thank you, Simon, but I don't remember feeling that brave. I just reacted."
"Right, right. But you must have been terrified. What was it like, Keith? The violence, death row, being with Boyette. Must have been horrible."
The last thing Keith wanted to do was tell the story, but the monk looked so eager. "Come on, Simon, you've read the papers," Keith tried to protest. "You know what happened."
"Keith, humor me. What really happened?"
So Keith bored himself while humoring the monk, who added to the narrative every 15 seconds with a bewildered,
"Unbelievable,"
or a clucking,
"My, my."
Once, while he was shaking his head, the crumb was dislodged and fell into his coffee, but the monk did not notice. In this rendition, Keith chose the chilling phone call from Boyette as the final chapter.
"My, my."
Typical of the monk, they had begun with the unpleasant, the editorial, then switched to the enjoyable, Keith's brave journey south, and suddenly it was back to the real purpose of the meeting. The first two paragraphs of the editorial commended Keith on his courage. But that was just the warm-up. The remainder chastised him for knowingly violating the law, though the editors, like the lawyers, struggled to set forth the exact violation.
"I assume you're getting top-notch legal advice," the monk said, obviously anxious to give his version of the necessary advice, if Keith would only ask.
"I have a good lawyer."
"And?"
"Come on, Simon. You understand the nature of confidential relationships." The monk's overloaded spine managed to stiffen. Chastised, he plowed on.
"Of course. I didn't mean to pry, but this does have our attention, Keith. There is the suggestion that there could be a criminal investigation, that you could be in hot water, so to speak, and so on. This is hardly private."
"I'm guilty of something, Simon. I did it, plain and simple. My lawyer thinks I may one day find it necessary to plead guilty to some vague obstruction of justice charge. No jail. Small fine. Record to be expunged later. There." The monk ate the last of his croissant with one savage bite, and chewed on matters for a while. He washed it down with a slug of coffee. He wiped his mouth with a paper napkin, and when everything was properly cleared, said,
"Assume you plead guilty to something, Keith. What would you expect from the church?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing?"
"I had two choices, Simon. Play it safe, stay in Kansas, and hope for the best. Or I could do what I did. Imagine for a moment, Simon, if I had done otherwise. If I had known the truth about who killed the girl, and I had been too timid to move. They execute the wrong man. They find the body. And for the rest of my life, I carry the guilt of not trying to intervene. What would you have done, Simon?"
"We admire you, Keith, honestly," the monk replied softly, completely ducking the question. "What concerns us, though, is the prospect of a prosecution, one of our ministers accused of a crime, and in a very public way."
The monk often used the word "us" when driving home a point, as if all the important leaders in the Christian world were focused on whatever pressing matter the monk had on his agenda. "And if I plead guilty?" Keith asked.
"That should be avoided if at all possible."
"And if I'm forced to?" The monk shifted his sizable frame, yanked on the sagging lobe of his left ear, then reclasped his hands as if ready to pray.
"Our synodical policies would require the initiating of a disciplinary procedure. Any criminal conviction would mandate this, Keith. I'm sure you understand. We can't have our ministers going to court with their lawyers, standing before judges, pleading guilty, getting sentenced, with the media stumbling all over themselves. Especially in a case like this. Think about the church, Keith."
"How would I be punished?"
"It's all premature, Keith. Let's worry about it later. I just wanted to have the first conversation, that's all."
"I want to get this straight, Simon. I stand a very good chance of being disciplined, whether suspended, placed on leave, perhaps defrocked, for doing something that you deem admirable and the church is very proud of, right?"
"Right, Keith, but let's not jump the gun here. If you can avoid prosecution, the problem is averted."
"Happily ever after."
"Something like that. Just keep us in the loop. We prefer to hear the news from you, not the newspaper."
Keith nodded, his mind already drifting away. Classes resumed without incident Thursday morning at the high school. When the students arrived, they were greeted by the football team, again wearing their home jerseys. The coaches and cheerleaders were there too, at the main entrance, smiling and shaking hands and trying to set a mood of reconciliation. Inside, in the lobby, Roberta, Cedric, Marvin, and Andrea chatted with the students and the teachers. Nicole Yarber was buried in a private ceremony at 4 o'clock on Thursday afternoon, almost exactly 1 week after the execution of Dante Drum. There was no formal funeral or memorial service. Reva simply wasn't up to it. She was advised by two close friends that a large, showy service would not be well attended, unless reporters were allowed. Besides, the First Baptist Church had no sanctuary, and the thought of borrowing one from a rival denomination was not appealing. A strong police presence kept the cameras far away. Reva was sick of those people. For the first time in 9 years, she ran from publicity. She and Wallace invited close to 100 family members and friends, and virtually all showed up. There were a few prominent no-shows. Nicole's father was excluded because he had not bothered to witness the execution, though, as Reva was forced to admit to herself in hindsight, she wished that she had not witnessed it either. Things had become quite complicated in Reva's world, and not inviting Cliff Yarber seemed appropriate at that moment. She would regret it later. She would not regret excluding Drew Kerber and Paul Coffey, two men she now loathed. They had misled her, betrayed her, and wounded her so deeply that she would never recover. As the architects of the wrongful conviction, Kerber and Coffey had a list of victims that was growing steadily. Reva and her family had been added. Brother Ronnie, who was as weary of Reva as he was of the media, presided with a subdued dignity that fitted the occasion. He spoke and read scripture, and as he did so, he noticed the perplexed and stunned faces of those in attendance. All were white, and all had been convinced beyond any doubt that the remains in the bronze coffin before them had been swept away by the Red River years earlier. If any had ever felt the slightest sympathy for Dante Drum and his family, they had kept it from their pastor. They had relished the thought of retribution and execution, as had he. Brother Ronnie was trying to make peace with God and find forgiveness. He wondered how many of those present were doing the same. However, he did not wish to offend anyone, especially Reva, so his message was on the lighter side. He had never known Nicole, but he managed to recount her life with stories shared by her friends. He assured everyone that Nicole had been with her father in heaven all these years. In heaven, there is no sorrow, so she was oblivious to the suffering of the loved ones she left behind. A hymn, a solo, another reading of scripture, and the service ended in less than an hour. Nicole Yarber finally received a proper burial. Paul Coffey waited until after dark to slip into his office. He typed a terse letter of resignation and emailed it to Judge Henry, with a copy to the clerk of the court. He typed a slightly longer explanation to his staff and emailed it without bothering to check for typos. He hurriedly dumped the contents of his center desk drawer into a box, then grabbed whatever valuables he could carry. An hour later, he walked out of his office for the last time. His car was packed and he was headed west, a long road trip with Alaska as the likely destination. He had no itinerary, no real plans, no desire to return to Sloan in the near future. Ideally, he would never return, but with Flack breathing fire down his neck, he knew that was not possible. He would be dragged back for all manner of abuse, an arduous deposition that would go on for days, a likely date with a disciplinary committee from the state bar, perhaps a punishing ordeal with federal investigators. His future would not be pretty. He was fairly certain he would not face the prospect of jail, but he also knew he could not survive financially and professionally. Paul Coffey was ruined, and he knew it. Chapter 42. Every store in the mall closed at 9 p.m., and by 9:15, Lily Reed had turned off the registers, punched the time clock, engaged the alarm system, and locked both doors of the ladies' boutique where she worked as an assistant manager. She left the mall through a service door and walked quickly to her car, a VW Beetle, which was parked in an area designated for employees. She was in a hurry. Her boyfriend was waiting at a sports bar half a mile away. As she was opening the door to her car, she felt something move behind her and heard a footstep. Then a strange male voice said, "Hey, Lily." In a split second, Lily knew she was in trouble. She turned, got a glimpse of the black handgun, saw a face she would never forget, and tried to scream. With astonishing speed, he slapped a hand over her mouth, said, "Get in the car," and shoved her inside. He slammed the driver's door, slapped her hard across the face, then stuck the gun barrel in her left ear. "Not a sound," he hissed, "and get your head down." Almost too horrified to move, she did as she was told. He started the engine. Enrico Muñez had been napping on and off for half an hour as he waited for his wife to finish her shift at a family restaurant in the mall's food court. He was parked between two other cars in a row of empty vehicles. He was still half asleep, and he was sitting low in the seat when he saw the attack. The man seemed to appear from nowhere and knew what he was doing. He displayed the gun but didn't wave it around. He overwhelmed the girl, who was too stunned to react. As soon as the Beetle lurched forward with the attacker at the wheel, Enrico reacted instinctively. He started the engine of his pickup truck, lunged into reverse, backed up, then sped forward. He caught the Beetle as it was turning at the end of the row and, understanding the gravity of the situation, did not hesitate to crash into it. He managed to avoid the passenger door where the girl was and plowed into the right front tire. Immediately upon impact, Enrico thought about the pistol and realized he had left his at home. He reached under his seat, grabbed a sawed-off baseball bat he kept just in case, jumped across the top of the Beetle, and as the man was getting out, Enrico slammed the bat into the back of his shiny, slick head. He would later tell his friends it was like smashing a melon. The man was flailing on the asphalt, and Enrico hit him again for good measure. The pistol was only a toy, but it looked authentic. Lily was hysterical. The entire episode lasted less than a minute, but she was already bracing herself for a nightmare. She scrambled out of her car and began running. The commotion attracted others. Mall security arrived in minutes, then the police and an ambulance. Enrico relinquished his prisoner, who was still on the ground, and began telling what happened. The attacker had no wallet, no identification, nothing in his pockets but $230 in cash. He refused to give his name. At the hospital, x-rays revealed a hairline crack of the skull, thanks to Enrico, and a brain tumor the size of an egg. He was treated and placed in a secured room. Investigators collected fingerprint samples, and detectives attempted to interrogate him. He was wounded and drugged and gave them nothing. Several policemen and detectives were in and out of the room, and one finally made the connection. "I think it's that Boyette character," he whispered, and suddenly everyone else thought so too. But the man denied it. 2 hours later, the fingerprints were matched, and his identity was confirmed. 10 hours earlier, on the other side of the world, two Black Hawk helicopters collided over the desert near Fallujah in central Iraq, killing 19 members of a Texas National Guard unit. The tragedy was just what Governor Newton needed. With Barry and Wayne in near euphoric agreement, they decided the governor should dash off to Iraq and show real leadership in the war on terror. The trip would also push him onto a larger stage and provide great footage for future use. And most important, it would get his ass out of Texas. His staff worked frantically to rearrange schedules, get military clearance, make sure the press was properly alerted, and sweat the rest of the details for the trip. Early Friday morning, the governor, Wayne and Barry met for a briefing.
"They caught Boyette last night," Wayne said, looking at his laptop. "He jumped a girl outside a mall in Overland Park, Kansas. No sexual assault. He's in custody."
"He was in Kansas?" the governor asked.
"Yep. Bright boy."
The governor shook his head in disbelief.
50 states and he stays in Kansas. A moron."
"What's the latest from Sloan?"
Barry said, "Guards all gone. DA resigned last night. All bodies buried. Streets are quiet, no fires. Classes resumed yesterday without incident, and the football team plays on the road tonight against Lufkin. Go Warriors."
The governor picked up a report. Barry was burning up his laptop. All three were haggard and spent, testy and slightly hungover. They gulped coffee, chewed their nails, and never thought they would be so excited about a trip to Iraq.
We have an execution in 12 days, gentlemen, the governor said. What's the plan? Wayne replied proudly, Got it all worked out. I've had drinks with a senior law clerk at the Court of Appeals. Obviously, they'd prefer to postpone the next one for a while. I told him we were in no hurry either. Word is being routed to the lawyer for Drifty Tucker that he should file something, anything. Just dream up some wild claim for relief and get it filed, preferably before 5 p.m. The court will show unusual interest in Mr. Tucker's case and issue an order, no opinion attached, but will stay the execution until some undetermined point in the future. They'll bury Tucker's case. One day he'll probably read our obituaries. I like it, the governor said, smiling. And when is the next one? Not until July. 8 months away. 8 months. Wow. Yep. We got lucky. The governor looked at Barry and said, How are things this morning? Here or national? Barry asked. Both. Here the big story is, of course, the Black Hawks in Iraq, but Drum is still front page news. They buried the girl yesterday, front page on a dozen papers. More editorials, everybody wants a moratorium. The death penalty folks are insane. They're expecting 25,000 at a rally here on Sunday. Where? At the Capitol, across the street. It'll be a zoo. And we'll be in lovely Fallujah, the governor said. I can't wait, Wayne said. Barry continued. On the national front, it's more of the same. Rants by the left, not much on the right. The governors of Ohio and Pennsylvania are talking openly about moratoriums until the death penalty can be studied some more. That's about right, Newton mumbled. A lot of noise from the abolitionists, but it's all beginning to sound the same. There's so much overkill that the screaming is becoming monotonous. What about the polls? Barry stood and stretched his legs. I talked to Wilson earlier this morning. We've lost 10 points on the issue, with 61% of the registered voters in Texas still in favor. Looks like I win the bet, boys. Pay up. The surprising numbers are on the issue of a moratorium. 61% want the death penalty, but almost 50% favor a hiatus of some sort. That'll go down, Wayne said with authority. Let the shock wear off. Wait till there's another home invasion with an innocent family murdered and folks will forget about Drum. They'll forget about a moratorium and remember why they favor the death penalty. The governor stood and walked to his favorite window. There were protesters on the street below, holding signs and parading back and forth along the sidewalk. They were everywhere, it seemed. Outside the governor's mansion, on every lawn of the Capitol, and in front of the entrance to the Court of Appeals with signs that screamed, We close at 5. Go to hell. From aging hippies to students against the death penalty, they crossed all ethnic and social lines. He loathed them. They were not his people. Gentlemen, I've made a decision, Newton said gravely. I'm not in favor of a moratorium. And I'm not calling a special session of the legislature to deal with it. To do so would create a spectacle. We have enough facing us already. We don't need the legislature creating another circus. We need to inform the media, Barry said. Prepare a statement. Release it after we take off for Iraq. Friday afternoon, Keith went to Elmo Laird's office for a short meeting. Dana was busy hauling kids and couldn't be there, not that she really wanted to be. With Boyette in custody, Keith was willing to let go of her, and she needed a few hours away from her husband. Boyette's final assault and subsequent arrest were being widely covered, and Keith was taking some shots. Lily's father was quoted as saying, Some of the blame lies with that Lutheran minister in Topeka. And that angle to the story had gained momentum. In light of Boyette's record, Lily Reed's family was relieved that the assault had gone no further, but still angry that such a career rapist was free and able to traumatize their daughter. The early reports slanted the story to read as though Keith had busted Boyette out of prison and fled with him to Texas. Elmo explained that he had talked to the DA, and while there were still no immediate plans to prosecute Keith, the situation was fluid. No decisions had been made.
The DA was getting calls from reporters and taking some heat. "What's your best guess?" Keith asked.
"Same plan, Keith. I'll keep chatting with the DA, and if he moves forward, we will work out a plea agreement, a fine. But no jail.
If I plead guilty, I'll probably face some type of disciplinary action by the church."
"Anything serious?"
"Nothing is clear as of now."
They agreed to meet again in a few days. Keith drove to St. Mark's and locked himself in his office. He had no idea what his sermon would be on Sunday and was not in the mood to work on one. There was a pile of phone messages on his desk, most from reporters. The monk had called an hour earlier, and Keith felt obliged to see what he wanted. They talked for a few minutes, long enough for Keith to get the message. The church was deeply concerned about the publicity and the likelihood that one of its ministers would face charges. The conversation was brief and ended with the agreement that Keith would go to Wichita on the following Tuesday for another meeting with the monk. Later, as Keith was tidying up his desk and preparing to leave for the weekend, his secretary buzzed and said a man with Abolish Texas Executions was on the line. Keith sat down and picked up the phone. His name was Terry Mueller, the executive director of ATEX, and he began by thanking Keith for joining the organization. They were delighted to have him on board, especially in light of his involvement in the drum case. "So you were there when he died," Mueller said, obviously intrigued and fishing for a few details. Keith hit the high points of the story in a quick summary and, to change subjects, asked about ATEX and its current activities. As the conversation went on, Mueller mentioned that he was a member of the Unity Lutheran Church in Austin. "It's an independent church, spun off from the Missouri Synod a decade ago," he explained. "Downtown, close to the Capitol, a very active congregation. We would love to have you come speak sometime."
"That's very kind," Keith replied. The idea that he would be sought as a speaker caught him off guard.
After they hung up, Keith went to the church's website and killed an hour. Unity Lutheran was well established, over 400 members, and its imposing chapel was built of red Texas granite, same as the state capitol building. It was politically and socially active with workshops and lectures, ranging from eliminating homelessness in Austin to fighting the persecution of Christians in Indonesia. Its senior pastor was retiring.
Chapter 43. The Schroeders celebrated Thanksgiving with Dana's mother in Lawrence. Early the following morning, Keith and Dana left the boys at their grandmother's and flew from Kansas City to Dallas, where they rented a car and drove 3 hours to Sloan. They roamed around the town, looking for points of interest. The Baptist church, the football field with a new press box under construction, the charred remains of a few empty buildings, the courthouse, and Robbie's office at the old train station. Sloan seemed very much at peace, with city crews stringing Christmas decorations back and forth over Main Street. From his first visit 2 weeks earlier, Keith remembered little about the town itself. He described to Dana the ever-present smoke and the constant wail of sirens, but looking back, he had been in such a state of shock that everything had been a blur. At the time, the thought of returning never entered his mind. He was in charge of Boyette. There was an execution pending, a body to locate, reporters everywhere. It had been frantic chaos, and his senses could only handle so much. Now, driving the shaded streets of downtown, he found it difficult to believe that Sloan had recently been occupied by the National Guard. The feast began around 5, and since the temperature was in the high 60s, they gathered beside the pool where Robbie had rented tables and chairs for the occasion. His entire firm was there, with spouses and partners. Judge and Mrs. Henry arrived early. The entire drum clan, at least 20 in number, including small children, arrived in one wave. Keith sat next to Roberta. Though they had been in the same witness room when Dante died, they had never actually met. "What do you say?" At first, the conversation was awkward, but before long they were on the subject of her grandchildren. She smiled often, though it was obvious her thoughts were elsewhere. 2 weeks after losing Dante, the family was still in mourning,
but they worked hard to enjoy the moment. Robbie proposed a toast, a lengthy tribute to friendship, and a brief memorial to Dante. He was so grateful that Keith and Dana could join them, all the way from Kansas, and this brought light applause. With the Drum family, Keith's mad dash south in an effort to stop the execution was already a legend. When Robbie finally sat down, Judge Henry stood up and tapped his wine glass. His toast was to the courage of Roberta and her family, and he ended by saying that something good comes from every tragedy. When the speeches were over, the caterers began serving thick sirloins smothered in mushroom gravy with more sides than could possibly fit on a plate. They ate well into the night, and though Roberta drank only tea, the rest of the adults enjoyed the fine wine Robbie had shipped in for the occasion. Keith and Dana slept in the guest room and left early the next morning to eat breakfast at a Main Street cafe known for its pecan waffles. Then they drove again. Using Robbie's directions, they found the Greenwood Cemetery behind a church at the edge of town. "The grave will be easy to find," Robbie had said. "Just follow the path until you see fresh dirt." The footpath was grass that had been worn thin. Ahead, a group of 10 or so pilgrims were holding hands around the grave and having a prayer. Keith and Dana pretended to look for other headstones until they cleared out. Dante's grave was a neat pile of red dirt ringed by dozens of bouquets of flowers. His large headstone read, "Dante Lamar Drum, born September 2nd, 1980. Wrongfully executed by the state of Texas on November 8th, 2007. Here lies an innocent man." In the center was an 8x10 engraved color photo of Dante in shoulder pads and blue jersey, all suited up and ready to play. Keith knelt by the headstone, closed his eyes, and offered a long prayer. Dana looked on. Her feelings were a mix of grief for the tragic loss, sympathy for her husband, and an ongoing confusion about what they were doing at that moment. Before they left, Keith snapped a quick photo of the grave. He wanted a memento, something to keep on his desk. The conference room at the train station hadn't changed. Robbie and Carlos were toiling away on a Saturday morning, with files and stacks of papers scattered among plastic coffee cups and empty pastry wrappers. Robbie gave Dana the grand tour, complete with an overblown history that Keith had managed to avoid on his first visit. Their first farewell had been deep in the woods at Roop's Mountain, and at the time they were not sure if they would ever see each other again. Now, 2 weeks later, when they embraced, they knew it would not be for the last time. Robbie thanked Keith again for his heroic effort. Keith demurred and said that Robbie was the real hero. Both agreed that they had not done enough, though they knew they had done everything possible. The drive to Austin took 7 hours. On Sunday, Keith spoke to an overflow crowd at Unity Lutheran Church. He told the story of his improbable journey to Sloan and then to Huntsville to the death chamber. He dwelled on the death penalty, attacked it on all fronts, and got the clear impression he was preaching to the choir. Since it was an official trial sermon, the church covered all of the expenses for the trip. After the service, Keith and Dana lunched with the pastor search committee and the Reverend Dr. Marcus Collins, the retiring senior minister and a much revered leader. During lunch, it became obvious that the church was enamored of the Schroeders. Later, as the prolonged goodbyes were underway, Dr. Collins whispered to Keith, "You'll find a wonderful home here." Epilogue. On December 22nd, the Chester County Grand Jury, called in session for a rare Saturday meeting, indicted Travis Boyette for the abduction, sexual assault, and murder of Nicole Yarber. The interim DA, Mike Grimshaw, had assumed his responsibilities with strict orders from Judge Elias Henry to get the indictment. The day had been carefully chosen by Judge Henry to coincide with the 9th anniversary of the arrest of Dante Drum. At 1 o'clock that afternoon,
a crowd gathered in his courtroom for an unusual hearing. Robbie had filed a motion to declare Dante not guilty and exonerated, and the state, acting through Grimshaw, was not contesting the motion. Judge Henry wanted the event covered and publicized, but he detested the notion of cameras in his courtroom. Several reporters were present, but none with cameras. It was another Robbie Flack show. For an hour, he went through the facts as they were now known and clicked off the mistakes, lies, cover-ups, and such. With the outcome of the hearing certain, he did not belabor any point. When he finished, Mike Grimshaw stood and announced, "Your Honor, the state of Texas does not dispute anything Mr. Flack has said." Judge Henry then read a short order that he had obviously prepared long before the hearing. Its final sentence read, "This court hereby finds, by clear and convincing evidence, that the defendant, Dante L. Drum, is not guilty of all charges, is absolutely innocent of all charges, and is hereby fully and completely exonerated. His conviction is hereby reversed, and his record is expunged. On behalf of this court, and on behalf of the state of Texas, I offer a sincere and thoroughly inadequate apology to the Drum family." With great drama, Judge Henry signed his order, then handed it down to Robbie. As scripted, Robbie walked to the bar and handed it to Roberta Drum in the first row. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals was still in its bunker. A mole had begun whispering, and when news broke about the duty judge, the story hit page one. Though the court did indeed close at 5 p.m., even on execution days, Chief Justice Prudlow assigned one of the nine as a duty judge, who was actually inside the building and supposedly monitoring the last-minute appeals. In theory, a frantic lawyer could call the duty judge and get some type of response from the court. It was a reasonable idea and not unusual for courts weighing life and death. However, the story exploded when it was learned that death penalty lawyers in Texas knew nothing about the court's use of duty judges. Their existence was kept quiet by the court itself. So when Cicely Avis arrived at the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals at 5:07 on the day of Dante's execution, one hand holding a box of papers and the other hand banging on the locked door, there was actually a justice upstairs in his office, ostensibly on guard. The court announced that it was adopting the electronic filing of all petitions and pleadings, but denied that this change in procedure was a result of the Drum case. A complaint against Prudlow was filed by the State Commission on Judicial Conduct. 2 years would pass before the commission ruled that while his conduct was unprofessional, he did not engage in serious wrongdoing and he should keep his job. The petition that did not get filed included the affidavit signed by Joey Gamble, the only alleged eyewitness at the trial. Legal experts debated the significance of his last-minute recantation and what the court should have or would have done with it. Joey left Sloan, then Texas. He blamed himself for what happened to Dante and found solace only in the bottle. On December 28th, the last Friday in 2007, Keith and Dana walked into an empty courtroom in Topeka at 4:30 p.m. and were met by Elmo Laird. Matthew Burns showed up for moral support, though Keith needed none. A judge appeared, then an assistant prosecutor. In less than 10 minutes, Keith pleaded guilty to one count of obstruction of justice. He was fined $1,000, given 1 year of probation and 1 year of unsupervised parole. Elmo Laird was confident that within 3 years, his record would be expunged. When asked by the judge if he had anything to say, Keith replied, "Yes, Your Honor. I would do the same thing again, if presented with the opportunity." To which the judge said, "God bless you." As expected, the monk informed Keith that he was immediately being placed on a leave of absence. Keith said not to bother. He was resigning. On Sunday, Keith announced to his congregation at St. Mark's that he was leaving,
to become the senior minister at Unity Lutheran Church in Austin, Texas. Travis Boyette now faced life in Kansas, death in Missouri, and death in Texas. For a year, the three states wrangled, often publicly, about what to do with him. When he told a Kansas judge that he strangled Nicole in Missouri, the judge ordered him transferred to Newton County. Since he had confessed repeatedly, he had no desire to defend himself in a trial. 16 months after his trip to Sloan, he was sentenced to death by lethal injection and sent to Potosi Correctional Center. Paul Coffey was eventually disbarred by a state ethics panel. He left Sloan and became a bail bondsman in Waco. Drew Kerber filed for bankruptcy and moved his family to Texas City, where he found a job on an offshore oil rig. Martha Handler won the race to the printing press and published the first of what promised to be a flood of books about the drum case. Her book was on the bestseller lists for almost a year. Her relationship with Robbie and the drum family soured when they could not agree on splitting the money. The indictment of Travis Boyette and the exoneration of Dante Drum put even more pressure on Governor Gil Newton to summon the legislature to Austin to deal with the aftermath of the execution. The governor and his advisors had hoped the passage of time would erode interest in the matter, but that was not happening. Death penalty opponents were ramping up their efforts and sharpening their tactics, and they were being cheered on by much of the national press. The Black Caucus, led by Senator Roger Ebbs of Houston, had only grown louder. Their vow of closing down the state's government until a special session was held appeared more and more likely. And the poll numbers were not trending the governor's way. A clear majority of Texans wanted the state to take a hard look at its execution business. They still wanted the death penalty, and by a wide margin, but they wanted some assurance that its use would be limited to those who were actually guilty. The idea of a moratorium was so widely discussed that it was gaining support. Finally, the poll numbers got the best of him, and Governor Newton called the 31 senators and 150 House members to the Capitol. Since he dictated the limits of what could be considered, the agenda would be 1. A resolution on Drum, 2. A moratorium on executions, and 3. The creation of an innocence commission to study the problems. It took 3 days to pass the resolution, which upon final approval declared Dante exonerated of all guilt and awarded $1 million to his family. When filed, and every member of the Black Caucus was a co-sponsor, the bill called for an award of $20 million, but the legislative process had whittled away all but $1 million. The governor, a tight-fisted fiscal hawk, at least on the campaign trail, expressed his usual concern over excessive government spending. When the Houston Chronicle ran its front-page story, it included the fact that the governor and his staff had spent over $400,000 on their recent trip fighting terror in Fallujah. The moratorium bill ignited a political war. Its original language sought a 2-year stop on all executions, during which time the death penalty would be studied from all angles and by all manner of panels and experts. Committee hearings were televised. Witnesses included retired judges, radical activists, well-known researchers, even 3 men who had spent years on death row before being exonerated. Outside the Capitol, rowdy demonstrations were held virtually every day. Violence erupted on several occasions when death penalty proponents got too close to its opponents. The very circus the governor feared had come to town. Since the moratorium fight originated in the Senate, the House began work on what was initially known as the Dante Drum Commission on Innocence. As conceived, it would be a full-time commission with 9 members who would study the roots of wrongful convictions and work to correct the problems. At the time, Texas had seen 33 exonerations, most by DNA evidence, with an alarming number from Dallas County. Another series of committee hearings were held, with no shortage of enthusiastic witnesses. After settling into their new home in late January, Keith and Dana went to the Capitol often to watch the proceedings.
They were in the crowd during several protests, and they watched the legislature suffer through the tortured process of coming to grips with a major problem. They, along with most observers, soon had the impression that nothing was going to change. As the special session dragged on, the name of Adam Flores began to appear in the news. After 27 years on death row, Flores was to be executed on July 1st. In another life, he had been a petty drug dealer who had killed another petty drug dealer during a bad night. His appeals were ancient history. He had no lawyer. The legislature recessed in late March, then reconvened the first week in May. After months of bitter infighting, the obvious had become even more so. It was time to forget this little war and go home. On final passage, the moratorium failed in the Senate by a vote of 12 in favor and 19 against. All votes along party lines. 2 hours later, the House voted 77-73 against the creation of the Innocence Commission. On July 1st, Adam Flores was escorted to Huntsville and met by Warden Ben Jeter. He was placed in the holding cell and counseled by the prison chaplain. He ate his last meal, fried catfish, and said his last prayer. At precisely 6 p.m., he made the short walk to the death chamber, and 20 minutes later he was pronounced dead. He had no witnesses, and there were none for his victim. There was no one to claim his body. So Adam Flores was buried in the prison cemetery alongside dozens of other unclaimed death row inmates. This is Scott Sowers. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Confession by John Grisham. This program was directed by Kevin Thompson, executive producer Orly Moskowitz. This program was recorded and edited at John Marshall Media. Text copyright 2010 by Belfry Holdings, Inc. Production copyright 2010 Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.